Decades ago, during a period of political and cultural upheaval in the United States, sound familiar? Many people went looking for alternative ways to live. That's when communes got big, briefly, in the late 60s and early 70s. People headed for the land to live closer to nature with a bunch of friends and stay away from the big city rat race and all that entailed. Our guest this hour joined a commune near Forks of Salmon, California. The Black Bear Ranch Commune is still in existence. Malcolm Terrence remembers it fondly in a new book from Oregon State University Press called Dispatches from the Klamath... Actually, it's called Beginner's Luck. That is the title. The subtitle is Dispatches from the Klamath Mountains. Malcolm Terrence is a man of many talents. He's obviously a writer, but also a timber worker, an environmental activist, a community organizer, and teacher, among others. And he's here in the studio with me. Malcolm, thanks for joining us.
For sure, for sure.
The book opens many miles from Black Bear Ranch in San Francisco with the Diggers, and this is a capital D. Who were they?
The Diggers, you know, they were so well known that no one in the 1960s would have ever asked that question, but I realize now that things get forgotten pretty quickly. Part of the reason I decided to write this book. The Diggers were kind of a revolutionary gang, but they were more theatrical than revolutionary with, you know, they were nonviolent for starters. A lot of them had come out of the San Francisco Mime Troupe, which was a very political theater group in those days. They still exist. The difference between them and a lot of revolutionaries is that they, instead of talking about it or theorizing about it or trying to have a war about it, they just did it. So their idea was everything should be free, all the juicy stuff for sure, but also things like free food, free clothing. They had a store where you could go get clothes. They had a newspaper they would hand out on the streets that they made with a kind of printing press in those days they called Gestetners, which was kind of the first... something like a mimeograph, but smarter.
So did the Diggers help guide you to Northern California?
I had left the newspaper business about a year and a half earlier, and gotten grabbed by some friends who were starting a rock and roll band in L.A. They were very talented. They immediately got grabbed up by Columbia Records and big booking agencies out of New York. And they needed a manager. They'd heard all these horror stories from other musician friends about how managers were crooks. And so they turned to me, oh, Malcolm's around. We could get him to be our manager. I think maybe they thought, Malcolm doesn't know enough to be a very good crook. Let's see if we can get him.
So did you spend a year or so in the rock star lifestyle or trying to guide other people away from the rock star lifestyle?
Well, we traveled around a lot and we overused lots of things, and as was the style of the times. I sort of wearied of that about the time we played San Francisco. We were playing the Fillmore, and I read one of the musicians had left the band and moved into one of the big Digger houses over in Haight-Ashbury. We went to visit him and just got swallowed up in the adventure. And suddenly, the idea of going back to L.A. and going back on the road and staying in affordable hotels, all crowded, and you know, we were well known already, and even made the bottom of the charts, but we weren't making much money, and it was exhausting. I think even if lots of money, it would have been exhausting.
The band was the United States of America. Was that
That's what we call it. You can tell we went through a lot of names before we came up with that.
Yeah, a lot of bands did that sort of thing. Yeah, lots of examples there. When you first heard talk of the ranch, about the Black Bear Ranch, way up in western Siskiyou County near Forks of Salmon, did you know anything about Siskiyou County? Had you even ever heard of it?
Never heard of it. The ranch was just starting. A few people out of that same big Digger house, it was on Willard Street, if you know that neighborhood, over near what's now UCSF, the big medical university. It was just a swarm of people, and some of those people had gone looking for commune land, and they'd found a realtor up in Siskiyou County. No, I didn't know anything about Siskiyou County. Siskiyou County then, and to some degree now, it has a lot different politics than San Francisco, say.
To put it mildly.
Well, one could compare it to, say, Mississippi in the 1950s, in my mind anyway. It's a lot different than even neighboring Humboldt County.
So what kind of an impression did it make upon your arrival? And you arrived as a guy with very bushy red hair and a beard, I understand.
Exactly. And that's where I discovered that it was, you know, I'd just come from San Francisco where you could wander around looking like whatever you wanted. And I was at the commune, which is a long, long drive in. The roads just got worse and worse and smaller until they would basically handle a log truck and little else. And I was there about 15 minutes, and the deputies followed me and arrested me and threw me in the jail in Yreka, which is out on I-5, where I spent the next couple of weeks.
So this is the strangest possession story I've ever heard. I mean, yeah, you got nailed for possession, but possession of a kitchen sink.
Exactly. We'd stopped at a little town called Etna, a ranching town out kind of halfway between Yreka and where the commune was just beginning. And we were gassing up the car. Next door, there was an old Victorian getting torn down, and there was just, I wandered through it, and there was, you know, people had gone through it a zillion times already and emptied it. I saw some broken plumbing in a kitchen sink, and I had heard that they needed plumbing up at the commune. I didn't know anything about plumbing then, so all plumbing was the same. But I went and asked the kid at the gas station, can I take things out of there? And he said, why not? Everybody else does. And so I threw the sink and a few chunks of pipe into the car. When we got up to the commune, very quickly the deputies showed up and arrested me for taking the sink.
Oh, wow. You got nabbed on a possession charge, but possession of a kitchen sink. Okay, so you didn't get the kitchen sink or the pipes and ended up getting 2 weeks in jail in Yreka instead. So welcome to Siskiyou County was the message of it all. This is from the book Beginner's Luck, Dispatches from the Klamath Mountains, a memoir by Malcolm Terrence, who spent a few years at the Black Bear Ranch and then elsewhere, and still lives on the Forks of Salmon in western Siskiyou County. You can join the conversation on The Exchange when we return to talk more with Malcolm Terrence about Beginner's Luck in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Malcolm Terrence, who worked for the LA Times many years ago, has worked for a few other newspapers through the years, off and on. Also worked as a teacher, timber worker, environmental activist, community organizer, and home birth expert, it turns out. We'll get to that in just a bit. His book is called Beginner's Luck, Dispatches from the Klamath Mountains, about finding the Black Bear Ranch in western Siskiyou County in the late 60s and setting up a life there and ultimately finding a place of his own nearby. You can join the conversation on The Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So once you spent your 2 weeks in jail in Yreka for stealing a kitchen sink from a house being demolished, you got out and finally got to the Black Bear Ranch. Life sounds very improvisational there in the early days.
Well, we were mostly, almost entirely urban people. You know, a lot of us were even college graduates, which is to say we had zero preparation for living out in the woods, where you had to find firewood, you had to patch up an old cabin to make it get through a winter, where in those days they had a lot of snow at those elevations, and take care of everything, figure out how to cook food without much ingredients, even deliver babies, because after a while people were having babies. We had the commune quickly grew to be 60 people, about 40 of them adults, and the other 20 babies and young kids.
And how big a chunk of land?
It was about 85 acres, but since there was everything around it was national forest, you know, basically we had everything.
85 acres plus everything around you, basically, yeah. As a running around place. You described the politics of the time, and for the folks who don't remember because they weren't born, I mean, there was a lot of upheaval. We're talking, this is the tail end of the civil rights era, the assassination of Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, the Vietnam War raging, Richard Nixon getting elected, and more. I mean, were at least some of the people who came to Black Bear just kind of running away from all that?
I think there was some escapism, and also we were just trying to say, we want the world to be different. Let's not just write about it. Let's not just argue about it. Let's go do it. And so there was, and that was kind of fit. That's what we got from the diggers, and it was theory. There's lots of theory out there. Let's see what we can do. Now, that means you had to learn how to do it. And plus, nobody even bothered making theory about how to keep your little cabin warm. You know, that one we had to learn a lot from locals or just by improvising.
So how were the relations with the locals? I mean, obviously the sheriff's deputies had some eyes on you when you first arrived. I mean, it doesn't sound like it was quite like other counties in our region where every hippie apparently was greeted at the county line by being taken to the jail and given a haircut. So it wasn't quite to that extent. But, I mean, how did the community otherwise, was there a fair amount of hostility or was there some receptivity?
I think there was mostly it was standoffish from everybody, but over time, we made a few friends and then other people would meet us. Then there were some big events, like there'd be a giant forest fire and everybody that jumped on a fire line in those days was welcomed and it changed people's minds about things. The other big one that was in the realm of environmental politics was at that point, the U.S. Forest Service was doing wholesale spraying of the clear cuts after they logged them to theoretically increase the growth of the new plantations. What that allowed was that they could then mine more of the old growth. It was a whole mathematical calculation. The downside of it was that there was ample evidence that the herbicides were toxic. There was a woman, a registered nurse named Mavis McCovey in the little country town of Orleans near us, who was also a Karuk medicine woman, who started spotting big clusters of birth anomalies that were probably linked to the use of the herbicides. And we organized on that. Now, even families of timber workers, you know, loggers, couldn't embrace something that would make their kids sick or not be born. And so it was a very unifying period. We were very successful in that, too, way more successful than I expected. You know, Paul, you don't always win in those kind of politics. You hardly ever won in those days.
I am struck by the crossing of lines that people assume exist and are very bright lines. But the idea that you had loggers who also would speak to you on the side is like, you know, we're not crazy about this clear cut either. But, you know, this is how we get paid. Exactly. And then you ended up working as a logger for a time, too, didn't you?
A little bit. It was so hazardous and so damaging in some ways that it was hard for me to stick in it. I did set up timber sales, which was kind of ironic. I would be the last person in the old growth. It came at a turning point, what they call a tipping point, I guess, where a lot of that kind of logging ceased. So a lot of the sales that I was a timber cruiser, they call it. And a lot of those sales that I set up never actually got harvested.
Oh, really? So you were the one who said, you know, this is the area you're going to cut, but they never got cut because...
Exactly. If there were ever 3 or 4 years of my life that I wouldn't mind my work squandered, that might have been then.
Malcolm Terrence is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He lived at the Black Bear Ranch commune in western Siskiyou County in the late 60s and for several years beyond that. He's written a memoir called Beginner's Luck, Dispatches from the Klamath Mountains. You can catch him tonight at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland at 7 o'clock. Tell us about your movement off of the ranch, though, because you weren't there terribly long before you got your own property, too.
Well, I was there about 4 years. Then I tried going back down to San Francisco again for a little while and then even did some farming down in Santa Cruz County, trying to learn more about ag. And then just got homesick for the river and moved back up. And I lived with some locals for a while, an old woman whose husband's family had come there in the gold rush, and got to know quite a few people, got to know some Indian families pretty good. And it just swallowed me in that community. I was going back to the commune, so I'd still go back to the commune a lot, but it was like, I always think of the commune as kind of a feral graduate school.
feral graduate school?
How some animals, if a pig gets loose in the woods after a while, it has more pigs and they're not farm animals anymore. That's what we'd become. In any event, I sort of learned, I didn't learn everything I needed to know, but I learned what I needed to know. And spend time learning it. When we first got it, there was one old chainsaw at the commune when we got there. And I'd never seen a chainsaw before. There was one guy that kind of knew how to run a chainsaw. And at some point he said, this thing's pretty dull. We need a file. And it never occurred to me. You know, I started thinking of a file, a manila folder. Oh. And I thought, where are we going to find a manila folder around here? And that's how opaque I was. Maybe that's part of it speaks to the title a little bit.
Beginner's luck, indeed. So tell us about meeting Sue.
Sue came to the town to be a school teacher. I already knew her a little bit from when I had been trying to learn farming down in Santa Cruz County, and I just fell for her immediately. If I went into a lot of detail, you'd have licensure troubles, but she's wonderful. She was a brilliant school teacher. We got a piece of land with a handful of other people. This was before the cannabis industry had inflated land prices. There hardly is any private land up on the Salmon River. It's almost entirely national forest. But even then, we found seven other families that wanted to buy a large piece of land and all built houses on it. And we've lived there pretty much all the time since, or on and off since. You know, sometimes we have to go off and chase other work or go on other adventures. But we keep coming back to the Salmon River.
Sue came with a son, and then the two of you had a daughter together. And I think that's what you have an excerpt here that you can talk about.
Right. One chapter of the book is about my daughter Erica's birth, but I also, where I first saw births was at the commune, you know, with 40 adults pretty quickly, where, you know, babies were born there. Some women had babies there within the first few months that we were there. And it was a little too far, especially once the place got snowed in, to get to the hospitals. Let me try reading a little bit here and see how we do. It gives you a taste of the book. This isn't exactly Erica's birth, although that's part of that chapter. This is an excerpt about a birth at the commune. The midwives grew more and more expert, and the moms grew better and better prepared. But black bear births were mostly still long, and the sense of drama never left. One autumn morning in 1969, my commune neighbor, Kathleen Nolan, went into labor with her fourth child. Kathleen was a highly organized woman, some would say obsessive. In her cabin at the junction of Black Bear and Argus Creeks, she had made a list of objects and procedures all week in case the midwives forgot anything. Sheets and blankets had been wrapped and taped in paper, then baked in an oven so they would be sterile. They sat in neat stacks near her bed, the paper faintly browned like great underdone cookies. Pots were collected to boil water. Boiling water seemed to be a key ingredient. She had me check the makeshift water system twice in advance to make sure it would work. We even sterilized string and a Swiss Army knife so she could cut and tie off the umbilical cord after birth. Kerosene was stockpiled and lamp wicks were trimmed. She ordered me to stack lots of dry stove wood and she cleaned the entire cabin twice. It was the cleanest it had ever been. So that morning, Kathleen waddled over to my cabin, which was next door, and asked me to fetch the midwives. I ran the mile to where one of them lived and burst breathlessly through the cabin door. "Kathy's having a baby," I gulped. There were a few women there, including the midwife. They looked at me with patronizing smiles and told me to sit down. "She's having a baby, and she told me to tell you that you should come," I managed. More smiles. How far apart are her contractions? I didn't really know, so I said, 10 minutes. All of them feigned urgency and said they would be right there. As I exited, I saw one of them headed to the stove to get another cup of tea. I raced back to the cabin. Kathleen had the stove roaring and the kettles approaching a boil when I returned. I scrubbed my hands and followed orders to change the bed linen. If the contractions had been faint and well-spaced when I left, they were now intense and almost continuous. For some of them, Kathleen cried out streams of profanity. At some point, a great fount of body fluid came pouring out of her. Kathleen took this in stride, rolled on her side, and asked me to use a new round of the baked bed linen. I was washing my hands so often, I expected the skin would slip away in the boiled water. "What next?" I asked. "Check the list," she said. "Which step are we at?" I asked, scanning the 21 steps of delivery she had painstakingly written the night before. "Baby crowning," she yelled. I think this was step 19 or 20. What about all those other steps? I asked prayerfully. My eyes settled on step 7, make herbal tea. That was something I knew how to do. Baby crowning, I asked, hoping for one of the easier steps, like step 3, stockpile firewood. Just watch as the baby crowns and let me know so I don't push too hard and tear, she explained, and then loosed another string of expletives. I had avoided the actual anatomy of birth until then and realized that the top of the head was actually showing. The head is showing a little, I said, and added, the midwives aren't here yet, so Kathleen might decide to show a little restraint. She weathered the next contraction with as little pushing as possible, but much more of the head appeared. Get the receiving blanket, she ordered. I was going to correct her because that was step 16, and we were much farther along, but dutifully I sifted into this stack of hermetically sealed linens. Quick, she barked, and I raced over to be there for the arrival of a long, sleek, new human being. Guiltily, I looked around for the midwives, but they were still a few minutes away. Kathleen looked at her newborn and announced that his name would be Emmett Paul.
Malcolm Terrence reading from Beginner's Luck, Dispatches from the Klamath Mountains, here in the studio at the Jefferson Exchange. And that was quite a moment in your life, in addition to the baby's life.
I just got a chill went through me reading it.
But that was life on Black Bear Ranch Commune. You really had to learn a lot of things in a fairly short amount of time, and some better than others from the sounds of it.
There was a lot of turnover. Some people didn't stay very long. A lot of people stayed there for more years than me. And then as we left, new people would come in. It's not as large now. In fact, it's very small. There was one stretch where I think there was nobody there, but then it restocked.
I'm fascinated that it still exists, though, that Black Bear Ranch still exists.
After it had gone about 10 years, it had been in one person's name, a guy named Richard Marley, who was in many ways the founder of Black Bear. And he was among the diggers, the one that thought up the idea. His wife, Elsa, found the place, and he talked people into making it happen. But it is still there. They converted it. After 10 years, they converted it into a land trust, and that's what it is now.
I did change that. This is the internet age, and so Black Bear Ranch Commune does have a website in which they talk about their history and talk about the old days and the creation and the change in ownership over the years. But they also tell people don't just show up and think you can move in. It's not like it was back then.
Right. People would show up in such droves. In those days, there was just everybody was in the road. You know, the standard issue was a VW van with a bed built in the back, and 6 people would show up. Some in the summer, that would happen 3 or 4 times a day.
Were there any understandings about, if you show up here and you're going to be here for a certain amount of time, you're expected to do something, you're expected to help grow food, till a garden,
That was an understanding, and we weren't very good at making rules. Hippies were good at lots of things, but that was not on the list.
Were there times when things got pretty hard and thin there?
Well, food was thin right from the start. And because the roads would disappear in the winter, you had to bring everything in. So it had to be stuff that wasn't very perishable. There's a whole chapter that I titled The Recipe for Chimichangas that basically talks about the scarcity of food. And lots of people learned how to cook. It's one thing to go through Julia Child's or The Joy of Cooking and run out to the store. It's another thing to go into a pantry that's mostly onions and beans and rice and a lot of sacks of not just flour but wheat and figure out what you're going to make to feed 60 people that afternoon.
So tell me, Malcolm, I mean, did you think at times that this was the place where you were going to be when the apocalypse hit? I mean, did you think, because of the concerns about nuclear war and then the upheaval in society and Vietnam and Nixon and all those things going on at the same time, I just wonder if you really thought something bad was going to happen in the outside world.
Absolutely. That was the background every time you left. I mean, the Wairika cops were not the only ones that had arrested me that year. I think I was in jail. Having long hair and a beard in those days it's finally when I began to identify with young men of color and the way they were harassed. The difference was that if you were white, you might get put in jail. You didn't get beat up. or usually didn't get beat up. You had to be pretty mouthy, and I had learned. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd been a police reporter for the L.A. Times. I'd worked in police stations, but then I was wearing a Brooks Brothers suit I didn't have long hair and a beard, and the cops didn't like reporters, but they were deferential to us, you know. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, I'm a target. It was hard for me to adjust to.
So, at any time did you think you'd come out to come off the ranch and expect to hear that we'd gotten into a war with the Soviet Union or something?
I thought there would be a civil war. Hmm. People would come through who were totally expecting that and getting ready for it, and expected everybody to rise up and try to recruit us. I'm not sure we were very good recruits.
All right, we'll find out more about life at Black Bear Ranch and elsewhere, because Malcolm Terrence did move off the ranch after 4 years and set up his own place, as we've heard briefly. And we'll get more to talking about his family and life and other things that happened, as described in his memoir, Beginner's Luck, Dispatches from the Klamath Mountains. He'll be at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland tonight at 7, reading from the book. And you can join the conversation here on The Exchange by phone or email if you'd like to share some stories of your own. 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Malcolm Terrence and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Malcolm Terrence, who has spent many years on the Salmon River in western Siskiyou County. He first came as a member of the Black Bear Ranch Commune in the late 60s. He is with us now to talk about living there and living elsewhere in that region. His book is called Beginner's Luck, Dispatches from the Klamath Mountains. He'll be speaking from the book and speaking about the book tonight at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland at 7 o'clock. He's here now, and you can join the conversation. Did you perhaps have experiences on a commune in the 60s and 70s? You're obviously not alone in our region. Join us on The Exchange with your story, your question, your comment. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So from your first days at Black Bear Ranch, Malcolm, did you think you were going to stay, or did you think this was just like, maybe I'll just, go back? You mentioned going elsewhere at various times.
Right. I was moving around a lot in those days, partly because we were touring with the band, and then I wasn't very attached anywhere. I thought I would stay at the commune, a few weeks at the most. But then when I got arrested in the first 15 minutes, and then they put off my... They released me after a while, I think, deciding I wasn't worth the trouble of feeding. I had to wait for a trial date. They set it for the following spring. This was August or something. And so I thought, if I go somewhere else, I'm just going to get harassed by some other round of cops. I'll just stay here. It was fascinating what was going on as more and more people were showing up. And it was exciting enough times. I thought, I'll just stay here and see what's going on. And by the time, the trial date came and went, and they reduced the charges to nothing special, but still found me guilty of nothing special. But then I was attached to the place and decided to stay. So in fact, I owe a lot to the Siskiyou, the deputies.
for making sure that you had to stay around Siskiyou County for a while.
Exactly.
That's really interesting. We talked a little bit about your family. I want to ask about some of the other people who are prominent in your book. And Kate George is a big one of those. Tell us about her.
Kate George had grown up in a upper class East Coast family. She went for a while to an Ivy League school, I think Barnard maybe, and then her family had lost all their money in the Depression. She had a job at a dime store or something and was the only one bringing money into the family. She came out to visit an aunt who lived on the Salmon River. The aunt left at some point. It's a longer story and it's in the book. And she picked up with the aunt's ex-husband, a gold miner, quite a bit older than Kate. And he was descended from a family that had come from Wales. They were miners who had come from Wales in about 1850. The gold rush hit the Salmon River just like it did everywhere around here. and they intermarried with the local, I think it was New River Shasta, and the family still identifies as New River Shasta. And she was sort of mixed. She was already in her 60s by the time the commune was going, and she found us interesting. And she said, "People around here, they do interesting stuff, but they don't have anything to talk about. They want to talk about poker and whether their Caterpillar bulldozer is working, you know." So we talked about other stuff, and she found that a novelty and welcomed. And she taught us a lot of stuff and introduced us to a lot of people who kind of tolerated us because we were Kate's friend, you know.
I laughed at your conversation with her about who to vote for in the race for sheriff of Siskiyou County.
Oh, right.
She said, should we vote for the drunk sheriff who's in there now or the younger, more snappy guy?
Exactly. She said, and the undersheriff's running against the drunk. He got a bunch of grant money and started all these new programs. And I said, so we vote for the guy who wrote the grants? And she said, you don't know anything about politics. Of course we vote for the drunk. I don't know if that's not the present sheriff. Let me say
no,
that.
No. There's many sheriffs since that time. But she said, vote for the drunk because he'll be easier on us.
Right. He'll be harmless. He'll be harmless.
So I want to talk a little more about your family because we had talked about the home birth story you had from earlier before you met Sue, and Sue came with a son. You had a daughter together, Erica, and you mentioned that Erica's first sight was a kerosene lamp in your cabin on the other piece of land away from Black Bear.
Right. Well, you know, most of the houses on the Salmon River are way off of grid. That is to say, we're not connected to regular electricity. We have regular electricity now, I'm proud to say. And that's a whole other interview, we had gas light, we could hook up to the battery of our car and have lights, but then you weren't always sure in the morning you could start the car. and that's how everybody lived in those days. And kerosene lamplight is pretty mellow. It was nice. It creates a nice light and better than a gas lamp. So it was a nice environment in the room where Erica was born, and I should say that there were very experienced midwives that came to that birth. One of them was a woman that had grown up on the commune, who then became a registered nurse so she could become a registered midwife, and she's been at thousands of births now, I expect, and I don't think she delivers babies anymore. She's even a little older than me, so that all stay up all night business is not part of the game.
There's a certain level of wistfulness, and maybe it comes from me and not from what's written here, but just the sense of people had to learn to do a lot of things that they didn't grow up doing. And there was a real sense of, you know, ad hocness about life and being able to improvise and have good results a good bit of the time.
It was an amazing time. We all learned so much stuff. I mean, the biggest challenge, and we didn't always meet the challenge, was how do you get along with other people? In the worlds we'd come from, there are all these established hierarchies. Some are based on rank and where you work. Some are based on gender. We were challenging all of those, but then you had to come up with something else. And so there was a continuous dialogue, understates it, a conversation, argument about what the world should be. The feminism got its birth there. A lot of questioning of gender identity got its birth there. Certainly stuff political, mm-hmm. You know, people challenging class and wealth. There were a few people there that had children and we got support from what's now called TANF. They would share the money. There were a few people that came from very wealthy families, and they'd get checks in the mail, what we called stay away from home money.
And, really? Like the families were saying, don't come back. Here's
yeah,
your money.
Yeah, right.
Wow. So was there any real structure to Black Bear Ranch in the 4 years you were there, in the sense of, like, were there, you know, people who were identified as the leaders who to make some decisions?
I think that some people made decisions. I think I made some decisions when I was there. Not because I knew the right thing to do, but just thought, we can't just sit and talk about this forever. We have to do something. And I'd listen to what people said, and I don't know quite how I do it. I think, okay, some people will come along if I say, this is what we need to do. And so that was my substitute for leadership. And a few other people did, many other people did that. But sometimes there would just be collisions. I'm making the gesture of a collision.
Right, yes, yeah, pushing the fists together. I want to come back to your daughter just a bit, because in addition to her being born, and you think her first sight was a kerosene lamp, I did notice Erica's name on some writing at the Black Bear Ranch webpage. So she, you guys still very connected to the ranch?
Yeah, she lives, she actually shares a big house that we have down near the bottom of the Salmon River. She works for a big restoration nonprofit out of Orleans. Before that, she worked out on the coast. She went to school like me in journalism and is a gifted writer. When she was first writing articles, I would look at it and think, oh, she stole that trick from me, and be all proud. And nowadays, I look at her writing, she is so good. And I go, I could steal that trick.
You could steal it back, yeah. Steal tricks from her. So over time, I mean, did life become more conventional eventually? I mean, you mentioned you're on the grid now.
No, well, we make our own electricity. We're not on the grid. We have a little turbine that runs off stream water.
Really?
And, you know, there's
from
a lot
the Salmon River itself?
Not the river itself. The river itself is a little bit too variable. This is but it's a big creek that runs into the Salmon, which is a small river. It runs, I probably have power more of the time than the neighboring towns that are on grid. You know, there's more problems with keeping a grid open up in the forest than there is keeping my pipeline intact. And, so that's how we have power. We live in a pretty comfortable existence. It's still, I still cut firewood. I don't fall trees anymore. But when the weather drops a tree, I'll cut it up into firewood still. I kind of enjoy doing that stuff. You know, and so we have wood heat. You know, we have running water. We have enough electricity to run a regular refrigerator and more. So it's a semi-civilized life. When I'm in urban areas for a while, I get a little restless because I can't figure out what to do. I sometimes write articles again now after the longest hiatus anyone ever took from any profession. But I just keep on looking around for friends in Santa Cruz. That's the town I go to the most. Saying, anybody need any wood split? They can tell I'm a little homesick for the river.
Why did you leave journalism the first? I mean, you mentioned being a long hiatus. You basically 50 years, it sounds like. So, but why did you leave the LA? Because we haven't talked about that step in your life. Why you left the LA Times and ended up with the rock band?
It just seemed like I knew a lot of people in the music business. You know, Linda Ronstadt started. I lived with a musician who recruited Linda, and they started their band in my house in Santa Monica when I was still working for the paper. So I knew, there was just a circle of musicians running around the house. And I thought, they have a lot more interesting life than I do. You know, I go to courtrooms and I go to police stations and I sit there and pound out one story after another. And, I'm missing out on some level. I think that's what it was. You're not very patient when you're in your 20s.
Yeah, well, that makes sense, though. You got to find some things to do with your life, certainly. What do you think about the world now in the sense of when I think about the battles over timber back then, which you ended up with a couple different angles on because you did work as a logger and a firefighter at times and a tree planter, as I understand, too. I mean, forest protection is a lot more now than it was back then, but then some of the other things that people were doing and learning and thinking about back then have fallen away.
I'm not sure which ones you're talking about. I think everybody blames environmentalists for the reduction in logging. I was out there. I know what's left. Yeah, the stuff that's left, they were already moving, at least in Salmon River, which is where I mostly worked. They were already moving into land so fragile that they couldn't even get their yarders out before the road started to collapse. And I can cite specific places.
So they shouldn't have been logging there in the first place.
Right, they shouldn't have been. So that's what was left. The plantations, they did clear cut a lot. They put plantations in. And they have a lot around here. We worked a lot up above Ashland, actually, and in tree planting. around us anyway, a lot of those plantations have burned.
Well, that, you know, I was going to ask you about that. You worked with, was it Ant Forestry? Is that what you call it?
Ant Forestry, right.
Which was like Green Side Up, and we had Robert Herning on the show just a few weeks ago.
Oh, good. I was just talking to Robert on the phone. He's a good friend.
And so you did the same sort of thing. It was basically hippies planting trees is
exactly
the way you referred to it.
Well, there were some other people, you know, some timber workers would jump on the cruise. We had men and women on the cruise, which was new in timber. The Native Americans came on the cruise. It was a good business. It didn't make a lot of money. It was a sector of the economy that was dominated by contractors who hired young immigrant athletes. And so they could pay those guys well and still make half the money for themselves. We divided up the money equally. We were making good money at the time. It was not unusual to make $15 an hour plus room and board and transportation. Back into the early 70s, people would think that good now. And because we were just divided equally, we didn't have somebody pulling half off the top.
Sure. Before we go, I want to ask about that. I noticed that the solstice celebrations are really big at Black Bear Ranch. Is there going to be a big one there this week?
I hear there's going to be one, yeah.
and your daughter's living there now, you said?
She lives, actually shares a house with us down at lower elevation. The elevation of Black Bear is about 2,800 feet. I live at about 800 feet.
Okay.
The snow is different, even these days.
Way down the valley. Well, the snow was actually a central feature of the book, particularly if you look at the picture on the cover of one of the forestry camps back in the day. The book is called Beginner's Luck, Dispatches from the Klamath Mountains at Oregon State University Press. Malcolm Terrence, the author, will be at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland tonight at 7. Malcolm, thank you so much.
Thank you.